Hey, Full Marin listeners, it's Brendan, and welcome to Producer Cuts. But before we get into any cuts, I just want to bring this up right at the front here. We are going to be doing another Ask Mark Anything episode, and we really like that the last time we did this, we solicited questions only from you, the Full Marin listeners. So we are going to put a link to Ask Mark Anything in this episode description. Just scroll right to it and click on it. They will be in the upcoming bonus episodes as well. And we want to get your questions for Mark for the future Ask Mark Anything episodes that will be exclusive to Full Marin listeners. And now we'll get to the producer cuts from the month of July. And this is one of those months where I have no producer cuts from any of the interviews. This is a Mark monologue bonanza. You're just going to get a bunch of things that had to get cut out of Mark's monologues. And I think one of the reasons why is that in the transitions between Canada and the U.S. and Mark spending time in Vancouver and then trying to get back home to L.A., you know, a lot of times he just sits down to record the monologues and he goes very long. So most of this stuff has been cut for time. I will say that there is one section that was cut where he talked at length the day after the assassination attempt on Donald Trump, and I thought it was probably not a wise idea to include all this stuff in the episode when it was feeling so fresh and raw for Mark, and I think that was probably a good idea, especially now where it feels like so long ago and barely anybody even talks about it. So this is a collection of monologue outtakes from episodes 1552, 1555, 1556, 1557, and 1558. And I'm just going to lay out. I'll let these play kind of back to back, and you can kind of pretend they're all one big Mark monologue. All right, we'll see on the other side of this.
Quick story. I flew coach home. I do that sometimes. Not on purpose. Had no choice. Business was sold out. And judge me if you want. Call me whatever you want to. But I'm not married. I don't have kids. I save my money. I will always fly business whenever I can because it matters. And I needed sleep, dude. I told you earlier, 4 a.m. I thought maybe I could get 2 hours on the plane along with the 3 that I got before. I hate watching the sun come up. Triggers all kinds of cocaine trauma. But I get on this plane and I'm in coach, I'm in the aisle, and some dude sits next to me with his wife or girlfriend. Dude must have been 6'5", big boy. And he just sits there, and I was just doing Zen shit, man. And he couldn't stop moving. He was fidgeting, and then he turns his phone on to watch a screen there. He's playing games on the screen of the airplane system. He's digging into chips bags. He's just, everything is moving all the time. Eating, watching 2 screens. Then he's picking up a book. He's reading that for a minute. It was like a giant toddler. And I was upset. And it was making me very livid. And I know that a lot of people snap on planes now. A lot of people say, yeah, it's because COVID broke people's brains. Maybe it did, but the closeness of it all, and I somehow or another in my brain said, well, he's got problems. There's something going on, ADHD or whatever. And I was able to muster up enough empathy for this guy who was, but I was able to muster up enough empathy not to make myself sick with anger and weird resentment. And I don't know why I'm proud of myself, but I am. I've got not a shitty guitar, but not a great guitar up here. So I've been noodling. I've been playing. I've been focusing on that, focusing on the writing, focusing on the thinking. You know, there's some big thing in my brain. There's shit, man. I start thinking about panic. I start thinking about worrying. You know, if you're a chronic worrier, it seems to me that you might be somewhat addicted to being wrong. That if your brain works that way, that if the relief you get is that you were not correct about your worry, or you were not correct, it didn't happen, that is somehow some reinforcing thing. So your brain is kind of spinning with all this sort of like, what if this happens? What if that happens? What if I don't get the thing? What do I got to do next week? Is it, you know, I can barely keep my fucking schedule together, but I seem to be able to sort of, in any sort of hour to 2 hour span, kind of just lock into a bit of panic about, you know, that hour or the next hour. But it just seems like it must be a dopamine thing, man. I don't need a lot of feedback on this. I'm kind of putting it together myself, which is usually the way it works with me. But there's just something about this arc of dopamine management. I mean, it's just, it's kind of baffling to me. It's not baffling. I get it. Look, I have an addictive personality. You know, your brain, if you have that, is going to figure out how to get it, however it's going to get it. If you need that push, if you need to, you know, kind of push back on being present, God knows that's a good fight to fight. How do I avoid this present business? But I'm telling you, man, these drug addicts in this town are just, I have not seen this much out in the open drug use in a long time. And I think I mentioned that before, but they're doing, the equipment they have, you know, they've got these, they're, most of them are smoking meth and fentanyl. And, you know, they got these huge torch-like lighters and they got the little glass pipes. And I've seen a couple of them with these pieces of garden hose. And that apparently is so they can get some distance between the pipe and their mouth so they don't burn their lips. And I guess, you know, the guy that figured that out there on the streets must have been like goddamn Einstein. The first guy that had the piece of garden hose, it was probably like, holy shit, that's a game changer for smoking ice. But the point is, I guess I'm trying to make, and I've been thinking about it since I've been up here, is that when you see these, you know, kind of tragic drug addicts on the street who have given up all dignity, all self-respect. And a lot of them are hunched over. They're on the nod. They're curled up. They're just, you know, some of them are OD'd on the street here. A lot of them are just running around talking to themselves. So you give up all personal dignity and you no longer, they are fighting against reality or the reality they're in to the point where they no longer have a degree of sort of self-perception, I would imagine, because they've sacrificed everything to sort of crank this dopamine thing going. And I think that most people are probably on the spectrum of addiction. If we're talking spectrums, if we're talking, like, I believe there's a PTSD spectrum and there's definitely an addiction spectrum. I don't see, like, whether it's exercise, whether it's panic, whether it's anger, there's all these different ways that you can get your brain chemicals juiced up, get your cortisol going. And depending on whether or not those are patterns, you know, you're addicted to something, man. And I've been talking about my phone a lot, boy, but that thing is one of the most controlled delivery systems of self generating dopamine and neurotransmitters that's ever been invented. I guess I'm just talking about it in hopes that I can get powerless and put the fucking thing down. You hear what I'm saying, huh? You know, I'm up here and someone tried to shoot Trump, and I took that information in from word of mouth, and then I did some, I looked at the news on my phone. I'm not tapped into American TV or news, so I was kind of just processing it from print. And look, I went on stage last night, or the night before last, the day it happened, after I had a little bit of information, and it was one of those things. And I've talked about this on stage before, about the type of comic I was, the type of comic I am. But there is an element of me, and I don't think it's unusual now, and I'm just talking about my own experience, where some part of me, because I had no one really to talk to up here about it, who was American, I don't think I talked to anybody that day on the phone even. But so I'm a little isolated, but I had feelings, and I needed to work it out. And the way that I work it out is through stand-up. I mean, I work things out here, but I become fairly calculating about what jokes I do that I'm working on in my act, or whether I should even bother doing some jokes here. This is a different format, obviously, the podcast. I go down to the Comedy Underground here in Vancouver. I'm just going to do a guest spot, and it's on my mind. And I feel I have a lot of feelings going into it. You know, this is an awful thing.
is one of the feelings. Political violence is awful. And, you know, that we're coming to that. And also that he's probably, Trump is probably a shoo-in. This is a great it's tragic, but, you know, it might seal the deal. So all of that is kind of churning in me. And also, like, how do I approach it? How do I approach it comedically? What are the risks? Well, the basic risk is it's not going to be funny. And you kind of ride that line with this stuff. But again, I'm in Canada and I'm doing a small crowd. I've got nothing to lose. I want to burn off some steam. I want to fucking, you know, release, not even burn it off. I want to release the valve a little bit to see if other people need that release as well. So I'm in the showroom and it's full. It's, you know, about 50 people, not huge, but it's a nice little club. And the host is on and he's, you know, doing a little crowd work with the audience. And it's just very interesting to me sort of what unfolded in the moments before I went on stage, because I had an angle, I had a plan, and I was just trying to formulate how to present it so it's funny. And as he's talking to audience members, he's asking people if they're from out of town. And there was a couple right up front that said they were from Texas, that they were from Dallas. And whatever plan I had, now I'm thinking like, oh, my God, they're here. I can't avoid them. You know, now I'm going to, you know, now there's an obstacle. I've got two people who are going to have a reaction to what I'm saying in that sort of like, you know, butthurt, snowflakey, kind of, you know, right-wing snap judgment, kind of, you know, push back, turn the talking points around. It's like saying that the Trump assassination attempt was brought on by Biden's rhetoric, which is ridiculous. They just, you know, hijacked the frame from the other side, which would be the frame that, that, you know, Trump caused, Trump's rhetoric caused, you know, the attack on the Capitol. So there's that. So all that's going through my mind. It's like, you know, there's only two people there, but it's going to be, I'm going to be aware of it. That, you know, I'm not, it's not secret anymore. I'm not just, you know, up here talking to Canadians. I've got representatives from the fascist state of Texas in the room. And now do I want to do it? Now, that question is an interesting question heading into what is most likely an authoritarian America. Like, do I want to do it? Like, there's other questions, you know, about it. And I don't think people really kind of take into account the full, you know, what's at stake here, how dire it is. Certainly up here in Canada, they don't. And I think a lot of people in America don't really what's at stake, what an authoritarian America looks like. We don't know. But, you know, all this talk about Project 2025 and what that implies. I mean, to really sort of wrap your brain around it, it becomes much bigger than me going like, do I want to bother telling this joke if I'm going to get some weird tension and angry reaction from people that think differently? That is self-censorship at its best, and it's protective, and it's like, what's the point? Fuck it. But that kind of thing culturally, where you start saying to yourself, and already people live in this environment, if you live in a red state or you work among, you know, people who are shamelessly, you know, celebrating, you know, what is really a type of Christian fascism, that you're already keeping your mouth shut. And then there's the old sort of adage of like, you know, we don't talk politics here, you know, because we're just people, politics are separate. Well, it's not separate anymore, because there's a momentum going on where the minority of people with grievances that have found a home for those grievances under the umbrella of really repressive fascist thinking, whether it be religious or in the guise of like, you know, anti-wokeness, are quite proud and quite, you know, loud and ready to fucking confront and argue. But when that thing becomes, when that kind of like desire to just, you know, mind your own business becomes a cultural epidemic, and then it just all of a sudden, you know, the need for legal or law-enforced repression becomes unnecessary if everybody shuts their fucking mouth and all that technology is already in place to just kind of steamroll people with different points of view. But those are bigger thoughts. You know, I'm just heading in to do a fucking 15-minute set for 50 people in a basement in Vancouver. But like all of it's starting to kind of illuminate itself. And look, the jokes were easy, but they were funny and they were of the moment. And you start to realize things like, well, is there even such thing as too soon anymore? I mean, I don't know that there is any too soon. You just do it as quickly as possible because, you know, by the next day, it could be too late. It's just the pace of media now. And I remember doing jokes, shortly after, 9/11 that were loaded. And there was just that nervousness. And there was that nervousness in the room. And then I said something like, look, this guy's been looking for a way to present himself as a real victim for years. And now he's got it. And he's going to take it right to the end. And he'll probably be president for life. And I said something that was more poetic than it was, humorous. But I said, as an American, that realization, whether it be emotional, who knows what's going to happen, but that moment of realizing that this is going down, that, that American authoritarianism is likely and a real thing, and it's not just a president issue, and it's not, it's a bigger fucking reality, and there's a lot at stake. And I said, sort of acknowledging that is kind of like being diagnosed with stage 4 cancer of the spirit. that's more of an adage than it is a joke. But, I got it out and I got it off my chest and I did the rest of my act, but it was very well received. And it turns out that I had misjudged Texas, that I had misjudged the idea of the Texans who were there. They were completely on board and in their own state of panic about the dire situation in our country. And that started to make me think about, well, what does it really mean? Because on some level, as a thinking person, as a rational person, you have to start to accommodate the idea and realize that, authoritarianism could be real and that it's somehow we're going to have to adapt to it. And there was an interesting thing that my buddy Peter sent me, about that day. It came from, I don't know if it was the New York Times, but it was an account, post-shooting. And it just said, as people passed the press risers elevating the cameras, some took out their anger on the media. Others sought out the cameras to offer eyewitness accounts, but they were jumbled and sometimes contradictory amid the panic. And then this line. The crowd trudged glumly to the parking lot, a few stopping for a last-minute hot dog or snow cone. That's most people. We're talking minutes, less than a half hour after. You want to grab something to eat? That's most of America. That's the America on both sides that doesn't seem to know what's at stake. The bigger question is, how does it look? What kind of job do you have? What kind of do people in other countries that are authoritarian, which is most of them, have those jobs? Can you live your life seemingly unaffected by what authoritarianism is or might look like? Now, what I talked about earlier in terms of self-censorship is one thing, but there is this idea that, certain states I don't perform in because I just assume even if I have a few people there, it doesn't justify necessarily me going. Just on a ticket sales effect. But, in the future, I think the issue with the reality of authoritarianism and the reality and possibilities of Project 2025 become on a state-to-state level with Christian nationalist, governments, state governments, what becomes illegal? I mean, already this is happening, with abortion, with gay rights, with certain issues options for diversity hiring and whatnot, a lot of things. But when it really goes into place, what's to stop a state government from saying it's illegal to say this or that? A lot of these kind of anti-woke, righty adjacent comedians yammering on about being canceled or this or that, which they won't, and saying all these quote unquote provocative things about trans people, about woke people, about whatever, means nothing. It means nothing because there's nothing really at stake. It's just an angle. It's a hook. It's a grift. But what's to stop in the very near future the legal enforcement of repression of voice, of saying things? Nothing. Nothing. I mean, with all the pushback that Lenny Bruce did back in the day, around the First Amendment, that can all become very, relevant again. And if you have, you know, Christian nationalists or authoritarian sympathists, apologists or just appointed judges in a state, who's to say you can't get fucking locked up in Arkansas forever for saying bad things about Jesus on a comedy stage? Who's to say that won't happen on a state-to-state basis? Nobody. Because the whole thing will be shifted. And I don't know that people really think about this. Look, I'm already uncomfortable in some places, but you know, usually there's enough of a group of scared, angry, progressive people that need a little relief, and I'll go put on a show. And look, I can perform for any audience, and I think that most of the stuff that I do is pretty, you know, clearly jokes with a point of view. But who's to say that somehow or another that won't become illegal certain places? Nobody. Nobody. And that's just the tip of the iceberg with the possibilities. Dire. It's dire. We're talking about music. I did a piece, Mojo Magazine has a questionnaire. They were kind of, I think, trying to promote the vinyl From Bleak to Dark. And there were these questions. And I don't ever know how to answer questions about one record. And if it's in the question, what one record, whatever the question is, I don't know how to fucking answer that. I just don't. Even if it's a question like, what was the first record you remember buying? Because it was a weird bunch of records for me. But it wasn't all that I was surrounded by. There was like these, and I've probably talked about this before, and I don't know why, but I remember what the records were, and I kind of think I got them at Skaggs Pharmacy, right down there on, on Lomas and San Pedro, if that sounds right. Does that sound right? Across from my high school's McDonald's, Skaggs Pharmacy, and those records, in my recollection, were Jethro Tull's Aqualung, Mountain's Greatest Hits, and the Beatles' second album. I know it sounds a little weird. Why Aqualung out of all records? And I'll tell you why. That fucking cover. I think my grandma had taken me down there, and I asked her to buy me these records. I'm like, look at that cover. What's up with that guy? And also, pretty great record, but it was the cover. And Mountain's Greatest Hits, I think the only reason I got that, also the cover, like what the fuck are those guys up to, was because they covered Roll Over Beethoven, as did the Beatles on the second album, a song I've been obsessed with, or was, at least my early life. And I didn't get to the Chuck Berry version until I got through Mountain and fucking the Beatles. But that wasn't all that was going on. My parents had records. When I was a very little kid, there was a box of cassettes that they had that they didn't play anymore. They didn't have a cassette player. And in that box, the ones that fucking blew my mind, Bobby Gentry's Ode to Billy Joe, Creedence Clearwater, Cosmos Factory, and Johnny Cash Live at San Quentin. Those were in the wiring. Those beveled some neural pathways. And in the vinyl area, Beatles' Let It Be, Melanie's, I Got a Brand New Pair of Roller Skates record. Chuck Berry, The London Sessions. Yeah. Yeah, My Ding-a-Ling. That's right. And also Janis Joplin's Pearl. That was big because I was a kid. I wasn't even 10. And I saw that cover of Janis just laying there all pretty on that Chaise Lounge, all dressed up. And I asked my mom, who's this? Maybe my dad. And they said she died of heroin. And then I just identified her as heroin. And it was sad because if you turn that record over, I'm like, those four look more like heroin. that band. But whatever. I couldn't just answer the record. What was the first record you bought? All of those. Yeah. And then they're like, what's your favorite record? What's the one record you go to, you listen? What's the record, your go-to record? Whatever the question was. And I listened to so many records. And I just started thinking, which one pops up more than most over the course of your life? And I said, well, I think AC/DC's Powerage usually gives me what I need when necessary. Then there was a question, what do you sing? Which album do you sing in the what do you sing in the shower? I do not sing in the shower. What's your Saturday night record? I don't know what that even means. So I said, Iggy Pop, Lust for Life. What's your Sunday morning record? What does that mean? So I said, Mingus, But it's all sort of random because it's like, how do you just have those conversations? What's the one record? I mean, it's crazy, right? Isn't it?
I don't know, man. I woke up, it's just like I'm at home. I get reconnected to the home front. It's very strange what's happening to me up there in Vancouver. As lovely as it all is, and I'm situated pretty nicely, and the work's been good, there is something about being surrounded by your own garbage on a personal level that is very grounding and I think essential to my fucking sanity. Sure, I come home. I've got things to deal with. I've got house things. I got to reconnect with the cats. I got to reconnect with Kit. I got to, reconnect with my car. I got to run a few errands around here. That is familiar. But this is the extensions of my neural pathways. These are my things. This is my life. And when I get away from it for too long, it's a kind of loneliness, but it's not really a loneliness because I'm okay. And I'm not, isolated. And it's a beautiful city where I'm at, but there is something about all the anxieties of your own fucking house that gets you right back into your own skin. Even if they're bad, even if I get home and I'm like, fuck, I got to deal with this. When did this break? How long has that been like that? What's wrong with this one? All that stuff, that is your life. And it's nice to be away from it for a little while, but eventually it's sort of like, what do I do without all this immediate aggravation that requires my attention all the fucking time? I know what I do. I get way up in my head. I start picking apart my life. I get down to the core of who I am, which is okay, probably a little emotionally younger than I'd like, and also surprisingly familiar in its mental spirals. Like there are certain things that you think like, well, I'm older, I've changed in these ways. But when you really sort of, separate from your life and sit there and meditate or think about or reacquaint yourself with who you are, you're sort of like, wow, well, that thing seems to still be operative. I thought I'd gotten rid of that. Just like never ending fucking beating the shit out of myself for food. But hey, maybe I'm alone in that. So stupid. So stupid. Last night I got home. I fucking went to Scaff's. Had the amazing baba and the cabbage salad. And I got home late and I'm tired. It's like 9:30, 10. It's not that late. And I'm like, I want some fucking ice cream. And it's sort of like, dude, you know, you're half asleep. Just fucking don't do it. And the next thing I knew, I was in my car driving around the corner to the Ralph's. 2-for-1 on Ben and Jerry's plant-based ice cream. Probably all the ice cream. And I got some and I'm like, oh, just have a little bit, feed the monkey a little bit. A pint and a half later, I'm like, what the fuck did I do? And I woke up with a goddamn ice cream hangover. I feel like my heart's beating too slow. Yeah, I'm back in it, man. Back in the game of my life. And it may not sound great mentally, but it's what I know. It's who I am. Oh, so much ice cream last night. Oh, on top of all that. Oh, I had to, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. This is just my cycle. Anyway, back in Los Angeles for a bit. And, I guess I'm kind of, what's the word? Insulated, isolated. I don't know what the word is. But I don't. Surprising things, don't always happen. And sometimes the mundane surprising thing is kind of interesting, right? There's unpredictable things. I wasn't anticipating my dad's wife getting into a fender bender or any, it's many things during the day that can happen. But the other night, like I flew into LAX late. I guess I got in around 12:30, and I usually deal with this car service that sends a driver over, usually my guy Tom. Tom's my dude, my driver guy, nice old Armenian Tom. We have a nice time, get to know your driver. I guess that's one of the luxuries of mid-level celebrityhood is that, and also not having kids and not having much debt and having saved my money. You know, I can afford these small things that are afforded a certain lifestyle. Like I got a car service that I use and my guy Tom comes and picks me up usually. But I knew it would probably be too late for Tom. But I get out of the airport, I'm waiting, and I'm usually I get a text from the driver, you know, when I land, nothing. I get out and I realize, I'm looking at my phone, I realize, fuck, I think I gave Jason the wrong day, the right date, but the wrong day. So I don't think there's a car coming. And so now I got to text Jason, who's probably sleeping, but he gets up and I'm like, yeah, I think I fucked up. He's like, yeah, I don't have anybody now. I could try to find some. I'm like, you know what? Look, I can just be like everybody else. Yeah, I'm just going to use Uber or Lyft, just the car service. So I set one up and I get a, you know, I ask for one of the nicer cars, like the, you know, like the limo type of car. I figure, you know, why not? You know, I'll just get one of those and order it. And then a few minutes later, it's like telling me I got to go somewhere. And I'm like waiting outside at the passenger pickup area at LAX. I don't know how anything works. And, you know, I get the driver and it's not a premium car. It's some little Mazda, some woman driving a little red Mazda. And I'm like, well, fuck. And then I text her because they give you contact. I'm like, I'm between Tower 6 and 6E and 6D or whatever. And she doesn't get back to me. And I'm like, and then I realize like, oh, fuck, there's no Ubers or Lyfts here at the airport. I got to go. Where do I got to go? 12:30 at night. I'm like, oh, fuck, there's a bus. I got to take a bus to an offsite place to get the Lyft. That's what these numbers mean. All right, fuck it. So now I'm running for a bus at 12:45 in the morning. And I get on and she's like, oh, I can try to come to the airport. But I'm like, no, you're not supposed to. So don't. I'm on the bus and I'm watching her car on my app and I'm watching me on the bus. And I get to this pickup area. I guess it's part of the redesign of the airport. I don't know how anything works. So that was sort of exciting to me. I wasn't even frustrated. I'm like, it's good that I know how to do this. You fucking, you know, get down. Come on. Be a goddamn regular person, you privileged fuck. So I'm kind of excited about it all. And I get to the zone, the spot, the offsite pickup area for Ubers. Me and everyone else waiting in the middle of the night. Some people with canceled car flights and whatnot. She eventually gets there. And the premium car is not a premium car. It's a beat up little Mazda. And she's driving. And, you know, it turns out she's, you know, comes in from the desert to do these runs to make ends meet. She's, you know, lives out in Palm Desert somewhere. And she comes and drives the night shift. And, you know, it's looking okay on the ride. You know, it looks like a clear ride. But right when we get on to the 110, there's some massive fucking accident. And, you know, it was like, fuck, I was so close. I didn't even think I was going to make the plane because I think I was going to be at... because I thought I was going to be on set all day, but the director did me a solid because I nailed the scene the night before with diminishing light, and he was very excited about it. And I said, just remember this tomorrow when I got to get out. And, you know, he cut me loose in the middle of the day. So I had plenty of time. So I'm like, hey, man, everything's working out. Right up till the last bit, the car wasn't there. I'm in this car service, you know, the Lyft, the Uber thing. And we hit this wall of fucking traffic. And I look at the goddamn map. It's going to be an hour. It just happened. Who the fuck knows? And there was no way off. But we figured one out. I don't want to go into details because I don't want to go, you know, get anyone into trouble because this driver was a hero. But we figured it out and we got off the highway and we're driving through the hood. And it's like, it's dark and she's a little nervous. And I'm like, it's going to be fine. We just got to get up past this accident and get back on the highway. And through the course of all this, you know, we're kind of chatting and, you know, she's listening to some sort of empowerment podcast. And, you know, it was just one of those things where we did it, you know, and she got me home and the ride service was significantly more than what I would have paid. And I gave her the difference as a tip. And it was just sort of a lovely kind of human interaction. And when I told Kit about it, she was like, oh, my God, this sounds like the beginning of a rom-com. It's too bad you're, you know, my guy. And I'm like, well, it probably wouldn't have panned out that way for a lot of reasons. But OK. But I guess the point being is like I didn't anticipate, you know, any sort of obstacle with this kind of, you know, just getting home from the airport. But it turned out to be a lovely human experience. And the woman driving me did a great job. And I don't even know why I'm telling you. I guess it's just me getting out of my bubble. And, you know, I just, it was just because it was so late at night, there was nothing aggravating about it. It was all kind of exciting. And that's where we are as a country. Who the fuck knows who's going to come in what kind of car? I don't know.
That'll do it for Producer Cuts this month. We'll be back next month with more of these. And like I said, we're doing another Ask Mark Anything episode, and we want to get your questions. So there is a link to the Ask Mark Anything question submission form. It's in the episode description. Just scroll to it in whatever app you're using, and you can click on it and send Mark a question that he will read on an upcoming Ask Mark Anything episode. And until then, this has been Brendan, and these are the Producer Cuts. We'll see you again next time.